Long before Yoko Ono became famous as John Lennon's wife, she had already established herself as an artist and a musical collaborator with the likes of John Cage and Ornette Coleman. She's also been a singer and film director, and Yoko's latest project is called Touch Me, an interactive exhibit that includes painting, film, conceptual photography, and sculptures. It'll be at Gallery Lelong on West 26th Street through May 31st. I'm very pleased it has brought Yoko Ono to the show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
If you get too close to some art at a museum, the Garnaway's ones don't touch. So why are you encouraging viewers to touch your art?
Well, because I wanted their participation, and that's part of my thing, I think, you know, that I do like the idea of sort of waking up their creativity as well.
And that's something you've done throughout your career.
Exactly.
I remember your cut piece, which you originally performed in 1964?
64, yeah.
You invited audience members to come on stage and use scissors to actually cut your clothing off of you.
I know. It was a bit scary.
It's scary. I would think I'd be more scared of the fact that people can get rather clumsy and you never know where those scissors are going to go.
Well, they were very careful, but, you know, it could have been somebody just getting excited about it, you know, of getting violent or something, but there wasn't any of that, really.
And how much did they cut off? You weren't completely denuded.
That was complete. Okay, so in Kyoto, it was not complete, and in New York, too, it was not really that complete, but in London, the swinging London of those days, the minute I sat down on the platform, they just, came and cut everything off me. I thought, oh, dear, what is this, you know? But, you know, depends on the place, I think, yeah.
Wasn't that performed as a protest for peace?
Well, at the time, it was not so much the protest for, or a protest against war. I mean, it was to do with, what women are, what women go through life kind of thing.
Because feminist issues have also been a main theme throughout your work.
Sort of like a quiet feminist issue, yeah.
What about Touch Me? Can I assume that some of it grows out of certain anti-war sentiments?
Well, I feel that this is a time that now the women are strong enough to be able to say, without being scared, yeah, okay, then touch me too, you know. It's up to now, maybe we were saying, okay, equal pay, you know, but no. The other side of this, that we're all human, we should all touch each other, that kind of situation.
Well, actually, there were artists who were doing that during the Dadaist period in rebellion against the whole idea of art being inviolable, you know, being forever. Dadaists were saying, in fact, there was a famous show in which there was an axe attached to a sculpture, and it said, "Hit me!"
Oh, hit me! Oh, that's good. Well, I think that's
and then people
different.
Cut down the wooden
Excuse
sculpture.
Me. I think there's a slight difference there. I think that you know, touching is more to do with love, maybe to do with caring and communication. Well, that's how I feel about it. But anyway.
Well, you know what your show is all about. Are all the things connected? Is there an overarching theme in the show?
The whole thing is sort of like a journey of a woman.
Included is a series of male faces called Vertical Memory.
Yes.
Composites that combine your father's, your son Sean's, and John's faces. What got you thinking about doing that?
Well, they said, but isn't this a horizontal memory? I mean, this is going from here to there. And I said, no, it's a vertical memory because it's about a guy being over you in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had a little contact with your father when you were a kid.
That's true, but he was always there in spirit, and he was a very overwhelming existence for me too. Yeah.
Is it true that you only met him when you visited him in San Francisco when you were 2.5 years old?
Well, not only. I mean, that's an exaggeration, I think, because sometimes when I wanted to have a talk in depth, I may have had to make an appointment and see him or something because he was very busy. But you know, in the weekend or something, when he's at home, we used to talk about music and art. And he was a very good piano player, so he was playing piano at home on the weekend.
But he was here when Tokyo was firebombed during the war?
No, he was in Saigon, Vietnam. In those days, you know, you used to say French Indochina was the name.
In your case, you were in Tokyo during the firebombing in 1945. Has that played a role in your feelings about...
I suppose so. I mean, everything that I experienced, and as I said, it's a sort of a journey of a woman. Everything that I experienced is in that show, in a way, in a very subtle way, I think. But... So, yes, of course, you know, I experienced the war in a very raw way. So that, and when it was, especially when I was at a very impressionable age.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut, his experience in the Dresden firebombing affected everything that he wrote after that. I'd imagine it's a very powerful experience.
You know, actually, what happened to me during the war, which was being evacuated, all the children were evacuated to the countryside, and I experienced something that I would never have experienced otherwise, in a sense of not having enough food or this, that, and the other. And that experience of that period really affected my body even, and even now I feel that that period gave me strength.
Really?
Yeah, the memory of that period is giving me a lot of strength, yeah.
My guest is Yoko Ono, who has a show at the Gallery Le Long on West 26th Street called Touch Me. You've been exhibiting all over the world in the past few years, Brazil, Italy, Germany. Your exhibit, Yes, Yoko Ono, toured the United States, Canada, and Asia from 2000 to 2004. So you're back to making a lot of art?
Yes, and it's quite exciting because I mean, even this year, probably I have about 10 different cities in the world to go to. And when that request comes for me to do something, then, you know, it's easier for me to do it. It suddenly inspires me to do the work.
It means you're traveling a lot as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you ever do any performance pieces?
I do that too, yeah. I mean, when I think from the day that I became 70, I became most busy, the busiest person in the world, so to speak.
When you became 70?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I started to get so many requests and everything, and it's great.
So for a while you weren't working as much, and then the 70th birthday hit, and boom.
Well, it's not as though I wasn't working so much. I wasn't a couch potato. Mm-hmm. It's just that when if I don't get a request, you know, I'm not going to sort of bang the door and say, let me in.
You're not one of those artists who goes to the gallery with a portfolio
and says,
hey, I'm an artist.
Well,
give me a show, maybe?
Not really. I wasn't that way. But I created, you know, sort of a different kind of environment to express my art and all that in the old days when I didn't get many requests, you know. And I think that was very interesting and it was good for my spirit.
Well, you were part of an art group called Fluxus in
the
60s, mm-hmm. Founded by George Makiounis. Is that a key to the work that followed?
Well, yes, Fluxus is a very good movement, really. And but I was there before Fluxus and after, let's put it that way.
That was a New York thing. You were already part of the New York art scene at that
point? Yeah, I was, yeah. But before I became part of the New York art world, I think I was part of the art world of the world, so to speak, or Japan, maybe. Yeah.
Although, at this point, were you still at Sarah Lawrence?
No. Let's see now. I just left Sarah Lawrence and came to New York, and later I met all sorts of different artists, very interesting, exciting, actually, artists who all came to New York for the same reason, because we were sort of attracted to New York City at the time. Yeah.
In fact, that was an exciting time for New York because artists could meet each other.
I know.
There were three or four places where they all hung out, and today it just seems to be so diffuse. Unless you know somebody who knows somebody, there's little chance you're going to meet the kind of people that you probably met quite casually at that time.
Maybe it's just me who doesn't really meet very many people anyway. But I mean, at this point in my life, in a sense that I'm so busy and everything, and everybody else is busy too. It's just one of those, it's a time when everybody's very busy, and the whole world is being sped up in a way. I don't know if that's good or not. But.
Were your parents living in New York at that point?
Let me think. No, I think they just went back to Japan or something. Yeah.
What did they think of your bohemian lifestyle?
Well, they weren't particularly thrilled about it, I don't think.
Were they happy that you were becoming an artist?
Well, because my father was an art. Well, my mother was an artist. My father was a pianist, and well, actually, they were, but they repressed that side of them, and they sort of became, you know, my father became a banker, and my mother was a housewife. Well, housewife is a terrible word for her. Actually, she's a very intelligent woman, who were put in that position because she fell in love with my father. It's a classic situation. But,
it was also the way things were in those days.
Yes, and yes, of course.
Still are in some situations today. Yeah.
So anyway, I think that they didn't mind it if I became a kind of a normal artist. Normal is the word, is it?
But not the kind of artist who would have strangers cut her clothes off.
No, that I think, well, we didn't talk about that, but I'm sure that they were rather upset about it.
When you were asked about whether you're eccentric, did you say, I have my own rhythm and my own timing, and that's simply how it is? Is that what you'd have told your parents as well?
Well, in Japan?
Or anytime.
My parents.
Yeah, this is the way I am.
Well, I didn't have to say that. I think that it was sort of understood. Sort of like a very sensitive relationship where there was very wise and intelligent parents, so they weren't going to start an argument.
Is it true that during your first ever performance at your Lower East Side loft, you used a stage performance to set a painting on fire?
Well, on fire, that sounds terrible. Actually, it was like...
Well, I had some paintings I wanted to burn.
Well, it was a smoke painting. It's called smoke painting. And you light a match and I put a little hole in it and the smoke comes out as if the smoke is coming out of an incense because the canvas was kind of prepared in a way, treated with some kind of wet material, so it doesn't really, it's not really wet, but it didn't really sort of burn. It's a canvas, you know.
So the smoke actually created the images on the canvas.
Exactly.
Yoko Ono is my guest. She has been making art all of her life, and her latest exhibit is called Touch Me. It is currently at the Gallery Le Long, and that's at West 26th Street in Chelsea. It runs through May 31st. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Yoko Ono is my guest. She has a new exhibit at the Gallery Le Long, L-E-L-O-N-G, in Chelsea on West 26th Street. It's called Touch Me, and it includes painting, film, conceptual photography, and sculptures, and it runs through May 31st. The only thing it doesn't have that you've been involved with is music. Now, did you become involved with music when you married your first husband, composer Toshi Ichiyanagi?
No.
Well, your father was a pianist, you said.
Well, not in that, but my father, when I was born, I think he really wanted to see if I could become a pianist or not, and was always checking my hand, you know, my hands, and he was saying, oh, no, this part is not long enough. I don't know, but it has to be long here, you see, for an octave and everything. And I literally think that at that point, my hands shrunk.
Oh, in reaction.
Exactly. And so I was not going to become a very good pianist. And when I was about 13 or 14, I heard my father talk to my mother in the next room, probably thinking that I would hear it. I mean, that's how it was. My parents, very sensitive people, doing it that way. Anyway.
Indirectly.
And he was saying, well, I think Yoko should stop rehearsing. It's just sad that, you know, she's not going to be a pianist, so just, you know, she shouldn't do this. So then I told him that I just wanted to be a composer. The reason is because, or was, that my mother put me in this a school for very early education of music when I was about 4 or 5.
This is before the Suzuki method and all of that.
Before the Suzuki method, yes. Suzuki method was much later. But that was sort of concentrating violin. This one was music theory and writing songs and mainly with piano. And the very interesting thing, this is in the 30s. So it's 37 or 8 or around then. And my teacher, the homework that she gave us was to listen to all the noise of that day and transcribe that into musical notes. How do you like that?
That's before John Cage.
Well, a little before John Cage, yes.
But it must have been something you talked. It must have been something you talked about with him when you collaborated with him.
I just never did. I don't know why.
Because he was also interested in natural sounds. There was that famous piece where people just cough.
For me, it seemed like a very natural thing to do.
Uh-huh.
Natural course that he was going. Yeah.
And it also sounds like the sort of thing that you've thought about throughout the rest of your life.
Well, somehow in me that I had this thing about, well, rebellious attitude, whatever you call it, but I thought that it would be so silly to just repeat some work, work of art or work of music, the form of work of art or work of music, and, unless you can find something new and express it and communicate with it or something. So that's why I finally went into something that, the people probably said, oh, she's shrieking, she's shouting.
Well, I've always wondered about the relationship between art and the Japanese sensibility, because, you know, the common thought is that if there is a nail that is sticking up in Japan, you nail it down. Everybody has to be the same. And yet so many incredible writers, painters, musicians have come out of Japan. So is that what happens when somebody's rebellious like you? They wind up being an artist?
Well, either you commit suicide or, you know, you stick out then. You know, but the thing is, yes.
Did anybody try to hammer you down?
Well, obviously, that was my life. But in 1920s already, the Russian sort of expressionism and all that was coming in Japan. And my father, actually, when he was 20, was the first one who translated about Russian expressionism in Japan, which was written in French but with Russian in it or something. And my uncle was fluent in Russian, so they sort of put it together. But there was an incredible interest in avant-garde art at the time, and I think that the avant-garde art around 1920s and 1930s were very, very interesting. I mean, Japan, yeah.
And then everything changed when Japan became militarized. And
oh, well, after the war, it was a very different situation, yeah.
So here you are in New York, and you've had this kind of unorthodox musical training, and John Cage is here. Ornette Coleman is making a name for himself at the 5 spot. Did you present yourself to them, or were you just traveling the same circles?
No. It was just not like that. I think it mainly had to do with, I have to say that, with Toshi Janagi, who was my husband at the time, but he's a brilliant composer, really. And so, you know, and a pianist. And I think Stephen Volpe, who's an incredible atonal composer, wanted Toshi to sort of transcribe some musical notes, his music. And so Toshi was doing that, copying music. In those days, you know, they did it with hand, you know. And so he was doing that to make it into a scorebook. And Stephen Bob asked Toshi to play his work in Carnegie Recital Hall. I think it was with three pianos or something, and he was one of them. And at the time, I was there too, and we went to a Russian tea room. Those days, Russian tea rooms where all these classical musicians will just go and have coffee or something like that. And we went there, and Stephen was saying, oh, I'd like to introduce you to John Cage. And so we said hello to John Cage, and it was like that, you know. So it was not something like I was sort of knocking the door, I want to see him, you know.
But you knew he was an important, you knew he was an important artist.
I didn't really know how important he was. And then after we met, I started to read his book and all that. And I'm saying, oh, this is incredible. I mean, his theory was fantastic. Yeah.
And then Ornette Coleman is another case.
Ornette Coleman, I met
him. He really
in Paris.
Was changing jazz.
Yeah, yeah. I met him in Paris when I was doing a show in Paris. And somebody said, well, Ornette is in the audience, you know, to Ornette Coleman. Well, because Ornette Coleman at the time in Paris, well, now to everywhere, I suppose, but was an incredible, incredible famous artist, a musician. And people just sort of, you know, just the fact that he's walking or something, they're sort of adoring it, you know. That's how I met. He was he came to my concert.
And how did the collaborations work with them?
Well, he asked me that he was doing an Albert Hall concert, and he wondered if I would come and do it with him.
My guest is Yoko Ono, who has a new art exhibit at the Galerie Le Long on West 26th Street. It runs through May 31st. And by the way, there is a slideshow of some of the work from the exhibit on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Somebody once said, and I'm sure you've heard this so many times you're already bored with it, that you are the most the most famous artist that whose work nobody knows?
Or something like that.
Yes, the most famous unknown artist in the world. Everyone knows who she is, but no one knows what she does. Do you think it's because you've done so many different things?
Well, they say that about, you know, it's an old saying about jack of all trades or whatever, but I didn't care about that. But I don't think that was what it was. Well, maybe a little bit of that, maybe. But the fact that there's so many other factors. I was an Oriental, and I was a woman, and also probably most people would have appreciated if I was a little bit sweeter.
A little more demure.
Demure. Maybe that's the language.
Well, if you were asked, what are you, would you say I'm just somebody who does a lot of different arts, or do you think of yourself as a visual artist first and somebody who is involved with music second?
Well, I started to get involved in the music before art, so that I can't say that, but let's see now. Well, I really don't know. I mean, if somebody said, what are you? I would say I'm Yoko Ono.
What led you to the musical collaboration with John Lennon?
Oh, that was great. I mean, everything's recorded, you know, about that. So, I mean, I don't have to talk about it probably. But I mean,
well, there's still all sorts of mysteries. People still argue over how the two of you even met. So.
Oh, I know, because see, one of the things that are sort of rather upsetting, or maybe I shouldn't be upset about it, but is that you know, the history has changed so much because people have different ways of wanting to describe our situation. But well, actually, the simple matter is that we fell in love and we were nuts about each other, and through that we discovered each other too, artistically and creatively, and it was just so exciting to make things together. It was great.
Do you remember what sorts of sounds you and John experimented with on the night you composed your record, Unfinished Music, Number 1, Two Virgins?
Do I remember that night? Well, I think I do.
Well, people don't always remember everything that happened.
No, but I mean, the first night that we got together, spiritually, mentally, and physically as well, so maybe I should remember it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also ended up being considered electronic music. Is that what you were thinking of at the time?
Well, yes. Well, you know, what we created then, Two Virgins, and I think it was quite interesting, and especially because we came from totally different backgrounds, and he sort of put his background in there. And while I was performing, I was thinking, what is that? What is that? What is he trying to do, you know? And I'm sure that he felt that way about what I was doing, too. But it worked out very well. It all worked out.
Well, you were definitely involved with Provocations as well, because the album cover, the self-taken portrait of you and John completely nude, led to people banning it. I assume you knew that some people would get upset.
Well, yes. I think that was not that wise. I think it was a very unwise move, let's put it that way, if you wanted people to listen to that music. But even if we just put out that music with some very sweet cover or something like that, I'm sure that they still threw their record in the trash can, which is what they did.
Well, so do you think that people are more open to it now because we've heard other music of the same sort?
Maybe. It depends on the person. I don't think that electronic music is that popular now, even now. I think that's the kind of thing that some people are interested in, yeah.
Well, you were being provocateurs in other ways. There were the bed-ins and all sorts of other things that you were doing, partly because you felt, I assume, that that the war in Vietnam was...
Well, yes, of course, you know, we were anti-war people. And... anti-Vietnam War, but basically just anti-war in general, anti-violence. And even now, I think that I'm carrying that around in a sense that I feel that we're still doing it together to try to make a more peaceful world, maybe.
Well, some of those things still pop up. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but there is this film that you're trying to have squelched that involves footage that was taken at that time. And also you don't want Imagine used in a film that questions the theory of evolution. It's, as far as I can tell, of all the key figures in the post-Beatles community, you're the most concerned with maintaining some sense of integrity in dealing with the legacy.
Well, I think integrity is very important. I mean, I know that there's a different idea about all this, and if it makes money, it's fine kind of, idea. I really think that something like goodness and integrity are still very important characters in this world.
Most people simply say, well, how much money can I get for it?
Well, you see, the thing is, there was a point when being bad is good, you know, like it was great, you know, bad. But then that went too far in a way, and I'm sure that many people are now starting to think, no, being bad is not that good.
In 2002, you created Lennon Ono Grant for Peace at the UN. What has that been?
Well, I just wanted to make sure that I would focus and give, shed light on somebody who's done something, a normal person who's done something suddenly that was actually very daring, but he or she thought that it had to be done, and to sort of give an accolade to their courage, so to speak.
And it doesn't it award, or at least it did in the first year, two artists who continued to create art in the midst of wars in their countries. That's daring, partly because most people are just concerned about surviving at that time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, are you saying that I did or I didn't?
No, I think it's commendable that you are rewarding people for doing that sort of thing.
So
this show, which is at the Gallery Lelong, Touch Me, is it going to travel or is this a one-shot?
I have no idea. When I'm asked, I make a good show. The best I can do, and I feel very strongly about this one. It's a gallery show, so it's a beautiful gallery, but naturally a gallery is smaller than a museum and all that. But the thing is, it seems like this show is like a seed that I planted, and it's like a seed that's shining. Well, could I say that about my work?
Why not? That was your intention anyway.
Well, that was my intention, and also it's the power of the seed, so to speak.
Now,
and I really like the idea of people enjoying it now because I wanted to make it fun as well.
You also have a new album called Yes, I'm a Witch, performing with the Brother Brothers. We're going to go out with the title song. But can you tell us a bit about that?
What happened was because the whole world was against me. I mean, can you imagine a situation like that? And then they were sort of saying, oh, she's a witch, she's real, you know. So I said, okay, I'm a witch. Yes, I'm a witch. And
you felt you were misunderstood?
Well, misunderstood. I mean, that's
an understatement.
Putting it mildly. But anyway, so I said, okay, I'm a witch, all right, you know. And I created this song, and I sang it, and I produced it, and I was ready to get it out in 1974. And, you know, everybody around me said, Yoko, you can't put this out. I mean, you just can't, you know. I mean, they're going to kill you. I mean, they already don't like you, and you're saying you're a witch, you know. So I think there was no way to put it out because, I mean, the record company didn't want it, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then this time, you know, it's probably, it's a different age now, so I'm sure it's all right.
Well, the statute of limitations is up on Yoko Ono by now. You're no longer a witch. In fact, you're an exhibiting artist. Touch Me is at the Gallery Lelong on West 26th Street through May 31st. And as I said, there's a slideshow of some of the work from the exhibit on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's listen to a bit of what they couldn't release in the 70s, but we can listen to now. Yes, I'm a Witch. Thank you so much,
great,
Yoko.
Thank you. Don't fit in your ways.